I hydrated last night. I've had a pot of coffee. I got some Clif Bars. I'm ready to talk plot of LA Confidential.
better strap in for 14 and a half hours as we go through the plot of LA Confidential.
Let's go, Shipbird.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Real DMC Podcast. DMC stands for Dave, Marks, and Colin. We're all here today. That's good, because it's probably going to take a...
Might be a bad podcast if we weren't all here today.
Well, I was going to say, it's going to take a three-man team to break down the plot of this film, because today we're here to discuss the truly impressive Curtis Hanson written and directed 1997's L.A. Confidential.
They were three cops who had nothing in common.
Freeze! Big B, what are you doing here?
Hey, you know me, I'm keeping the streets safe, boys.
One would do anything to get ahead.
You're truly prepared to be despised within the department?
Yes, sir, I am.
One had his own brand of justice.
How's it gonna look in your report?
It'll look like justice. That's what the man got.
And one loved the spotlight.
What exactly do you do on the show, Jack?
I teach Brett Chase how to walk and talk like a cop.
The Night Owl Massacre. This is a heinous crime that requires swift resolution.
But what started as a murder...
You talk only to me on this one.
...became a mystery that could cost them everything. Academy Award winner Kevin Spacey, Russell Crowe, Guy Pearce, James Cromwell, Kim Basinger, Danny DeVito. L.A. Confidential.
All right, just a few quick upfront facts about the film. So it does maintain an 8.2 rating on IMDb. So it's very highly regarded. It was made originally for a budget of $35 million, and it made about $126 million worldwide. It was actually split across 2 years. So in 1997, it came in at number 65, and in 1998, it came in at number 58. So that was one thing I actually thought was pretty interesting was it was released in September of 97, but it actually ended up making more money in 98. So it must have been a slow burn success at the box office.
I think it got a big Oscar bump.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that too. Because it's not like that. I imagine it was hard to market the movie. It's not really an action movie. It's not really a thriller. It's a very much a character piece. So I think it's definitely an Oscar candidate in that Oscar bump. It did win a couple of Oscars and nominated for 9 total. So I'm sure that helped it out a bunch.
Yeah, it was actually nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Cinematography, Best Art Direction, Best Original Score, Best Film Editing, Best Sound. It was nominated for all those and it did not win. And then Best Supporting Actress.
It went up against the Titanic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Titanic won 11 Oscars, if you don't remember. So it kind of cleaned house.
Yeah. Kim Basinger did win for Best Supporting Actress, which I think is good because, at least in the Titanic sense, because I don't know, that old bag she was nominated against, whatever the...
Nice.
Gloria Stewart? That old bag? That oh, old come bag. On, man.
Yeah,
I think
throw the necklace in the ocean and shut the fuck up. Right?
Since we're talking about the Oscars, I thought it was interesting that the three leads, so Russell Crowe, Kevin Spacey, and Guy Pearce, none of them were nominated for a Oscar category. And I think it's because they probably split. The three were super strong, and I think any one of them, or all three, probably could have been nominated. But I think between Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe, they kind of split the Best Actor, and Kevin Spacey. I would have expected him to get a nomination for a Supporting Actor, but even he didn't get a nomination.
Yeah, I think because it is more of an ensemble picture, that maybe they just felt like it wasn't right to nominate any one person in like Best Actor role. Then again, the Oscars have done it many times. They've given somebody like Best Actor Oscar for someone who had like, you know, probably 10 minutes of screen time.
Marcus, I actually thought you were going to say that Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe split the Australian vote. That's what I thought you were going to say.
There's that too. Yeah. This was like sort of, I feel like it's sort of the era before, or this is like the Australian invasion. This is like the vanguard of the Australian invasion actors.
You know. Is Guy Pearce Australian?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. He was great. And this was a couple of years before Memento, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because that was in, 2000?
Something like that. Yeah. The winner was Jack Nicholson for As Good As It Gets. And then for a supporting role was Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting. Jack Nicholson, I don't know.
Oh, no. That's a really good performance in As Good As It Gets, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's also tough because he's a icon. So I think just a nomination would have been
Well, so what do you think about the Kim Basinger win?
I like it. I think she's really great in this. But I also really love Julianne Moore in Boogie Nights.
I was going to say, so that's the one when you look at the list of the other people that were up for the Oscar, definitely Julianne Moore. You can make a good argument there.
Yeah, I'm not against it. Like, I was surprised when I saw it. These guys had to be nominated, so I went and looked up the Oscars, and their one acting win was Kim Basinger. I'm like, she wasn't that strong. She was great, it's a great role, and she deserves it, I think. But I think the three leads definitely have stronger performances.
Okay, so if you had to pick one of the three leads, who had the best or the strongest performance?
It's tough. I'd probably say Guy Pearce. I think he does a lot with his character, and I think he does it really, really well.
I disagree. I think it's totally Russell Crowe.
That's funny because I could almost make an argument for Spacey because I love the way that Spacey is just kind of, sort of sliding his way through this movie. Like a lot of his, the smooth antics. Apparently, his character was based on, he asked Curtis Hanson, he said, if this movie had been made in the 50s, what actor would have played my role? And the answer was Dean Martin. And so apparently Spacey took that and used that as inspiration for his Vincennes character.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
I love Russell Crowe's intensity. I think he's so good. And I think he shows a good range as well. Like specifically the scene with Lynn when he confronts her. I feel that's one of his strongest scenes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think all three. I mean, it's a tough to pick out of them. Kevin Spacey seems like he does that character quite often. He's fantastic in that character, in that role. So he's a great, great fit for
He crushes the role. Self-loathing, for sure.
Yeah. And they all do a great job of still bringing like a little bit of honor and a little bit of respect to the roles. Like what they're all almost good people, but they also have that dark side of them that they all do a great job with it too. Like I just think Guy Pearce does more with it. Like Russell Crowe's fantastic too. So it's very like splitting hairs on which one you'd pick. But Russell Crowe the tough guy seems like an easier position. Whereas like the kind of college student walking the line, but willing to break the line too when it benefits him. Like he did a great job with it, I thought so.
I think that Guy Pearce has a couple scenes where he's really, really strong. But then there's others where I'm not so sure.
We should talk about that as we go through it. In terms of the production history, so it's pretty interesting because this is based on the James Ellroy novel, which is LA Confidential, and apparently the Confidential in there is based on a real magazine name that was a gossip magazine from the early 50s in Los Angeles.
Oh, Hush Hush.
Yeah. So in this case, it becomes Hush Hush for the movie, but apparently I guess there was a Confidential, was a gossip magazine that was in Los Angeles at the time.
Interestingly, it was actually called La Confidential.
La Confidential. So the other thing that was interesting is, so Curtis Hanson, I thought this was a really good quote because he was talking about, what was it that got him so interested in the material? And what he said was, there was a quote where he said, what hooked me on them was that as I met them one after the other, I didn't like them, but as I continued reading, I started to care about them. And so he was talking about the characters, like the three main leads. And apparently, I guess the book itself is far more complicated. There are 7 or 8 different plot lines in the book. So you can only imagine that it's like crazy complicated because this is a relatively complicated movie. I would say you have to pay attention as you go through it. But I do like the fact that I think that's a really good description because each of these characters very much in the gray area, right? So, I mean, they do, good and bad things throughout the movie. I mean, they're actually, I would say maybe Exley is the closest to being a good person, but certainly Vincennes and Bud White are not necessarily good guys. I mean, they have they're very in the gray area for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a key part
noir.
Noir, right?
Yeah.
It's like morally ambiguous characters. And that's why this is a really good film noir film.
Yeah.
This is a good film noir. A good film noir? Is it Dracar noir?
It's film noir and it's a film. It's everything you need.
Okay.
It's all the noir you're looking for.
Crime noir.
Now that we got that.
Crime noir.
Worked out. Yeah, it's interesting. How did you guys watch the movie?
I used my eyes. And my ears.
Okay, smart guy. Streaming.
Oh, no, actually, I own this movie. Yeah, so I watched my copy.
Do you have the Blu-ray?
I own the MP4.
Yes, I have the Blu-ray and the digital copy.
Yeah, I think I had the DVD a long time ago, and I ripped all my DVDs to MPEGs.
No, you didn't.
No, you didn't. That didn't happen because that's technically piracy. Yeah.
That was just a dream that you had one night.
No. I don't think for like your own, you can do it for your own use. Like if you didn't play it on a different device or something like that. I don't even own a DVD player. So what am I supposed to do?
All right. Well, I guess so.
Well, Colin, why did you ask that? Out of curiosity.
No, I just asked it because I owned the DVD for like a long time. And then I finally got the Blu-ray and finally got a chance to watch the Blu-ray version. And I saw that there were all these special features on there. So I ended up like watching all of those yesterday as well.
Oh, good.
It was pretty interesting. And they did one where they focused on the sort of the adaptation from book to film. And so James Ellroy said they took like 20% of the plot lines and used that for the movie and left like 80% out. Because it would have been, first of all, it was already very, very difficult to adapt.
Right.
That would have been, you know, there's no way it would have been impossible to have the rest of that. It was like a 500 page novel. I'm sort of interested in reading it because there's stuff that where they go into like Exley's backstory when he was in World War II. And I think it would be like really, really interesting. There's stuff they left out of these characters. But then there's like also a lot of,
I think I tried to read maybe one of his, Black Dahlia or something.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that Chris Pine. What was it called? Into the Night?
Yeah, it was something awful. Like
that. Oh, you didn't like it? I loved it.
Well, it didn't.
I really like Chris Pine. It wasn't like, it was like a USA movie or something, right?
Yeah.
A USA series.
Yeah.
Didn't De Palma actually make a version of the Black Dahlia?
Yeah, that was awful too.
Yeah, I never saw that.
Yeah, I didn't see that one.
So apparently there's three novels. This is like a trilogy with these characters, or at least many of the characters.
Some even say a quartet.
The LA Quartet.
Why a quartet?
Because there's four
books.
There were four books. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I didn't really do a ton of research.
Obviously.
Well, hey, getting back to just, you said you watched this on Blu-ray. So out of curiosity, when's the last time that you guys saw this movie? Not the last time you immediately watched it for this podcast. I know we always do that. Prior to this, prior to the most recent rewatch, when's the last time you watched this movie?
Probably 15, 20 years. I didn't watch this one that often. I mean, it's a pretty dense movie, so it's not something that you just easily like just flip on and, you know, cruise through it. So I don't think I've watched it that many times. So probably 20 years.
How about you, Colin?
Oh, the last time I watched it all the way through was probably maybe like 5 years ago. But before then, I would watch this like over and over and over again because I just loved it. Specifically, the first half of the movie, I really love. There's just so many great things about it. So it was kind of weird watching this again because I think with certain movies, I just kind of, I think I've just worn them out. So I wasn't super excited to watch it again. Even though it was my pick, I have a weird way of picking movies.
Well, actually, was your pick, Colin. So I'm curious, why this particular movie? What was it that you wanted to do in terms of rewatching it?
Well, like I said, it's one of my favorite movies, and like I said, I have watched it a million times. I have a certain affinity for movies that take place in like period LA. I really like them, and one of the things I love about this one is that it's so authentically done. Like they did the period part so well. So it's got amazing production design and costumes, but none of it is like in your face. So it's subtle. It's well-crafted. It's not distracting. And I just feel like I'm there in, you know, like 1953 LA.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really captures the mood.
And it's noir and it does have this incredibly complex plot. And so, you know, honestly, when I was watching it yesterday, I was like, I'm not really quite sure how this ends, even though I've seen it so many times, you know?
That's funny.
Yeah, well, so I do have, as we go through it, there are a couple key moments where I have some questions about
I think I can answer them.
No, I mean, I think I know the entire plot. I mean, I could tell you the crime and the sequencing and what happened, but how some of the characters come upon those particular revelations, I think. There's one in particular, but we can talk about it.
What I really love is that aspect of there is like a character behind the scenes, like a puppeteer pulling, like there's all sorts of things happening that you don't see at all, which is, to me, makes it really interesting, especially as you uncover the full plot and you realize like, okay, something else happened with that phone call, or something else happened with this, or like other people are talking, and all these things are happening that you don't really know about, which is really cool. Makes it very interesting. And you kind of feel it through the movie too, I thought.
Or you make assumptions, because like the whole thing with like, with Dudley and the Victory Motel, you think it's one thing because they tell you that, but it's actually something different. And you don't find out until the end.
But also like character motivations and things like that too. It's definitely like, oh, why are they doing this or what? You know.
So how about Curtis Hanson as a director for you guys? Are you a fan of his films?
Yeah, but I honestly think I can only name two. This and Wonder Boys.
So The River Wild is the other one that comes to mind for me.
He also did 8 Mile.
And 8 Mile, of course. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is what I'm saying, is they're the only two that I could name.
Well, and apparently he also did Bad Influence and The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. In the early 90s.
Bad Influence is a movie that I'd like to watch again.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
I think the hard part is like, it doesn't feel like he has a particular style to me. Like, I know like a lot of these movies are good, but I wouldn't say like, oh, that's a Curtis Hanson movie, right? They seem very like 8 Mile and LA Confidential and Bad Influence or The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. They're all very, very different movies.
Yeah, The River Wild. I might have to pick that at one point because I really like that movie. I think that's well done. All right. Well, you guys want to talk cast, or actually anything else you want to do up front just in terms of production?
Lynn Bracken's house is in Hancock Park, and it just sold in January for $6.4 million.
Jeez. I did love the intro, the voiceover, where Danny V is talking about the come to LA. It's plenty of land and affordable
cheap land
homes.
And orange groves. Yeah.
Like that didn't age well.
Not anymore.
Well, no, I think that aged great because that's exactly, you know, what it used to be. And
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So it's stuff like that. Stuff like the, you know, the little very short scene with opening up the Santa Monica Freeway construction, right? Stuff like that. I just think it's like totally cool from an LA history point of view.
I do love the old time corruption. Like it's this in like Chinatown and some over like very basic like water freeways. It's not like your typical like, oh, we're going to go rob a bank and drag it through the streets of Brazil or whatever the Fast and Furious, you know, like it's like, these are very, very basic
blackmailing, like getting people to change votes, et cetera.
Yeah. Like it's almost small town, but like, obviously it's a huge city.
But it really wasn't until like, it was just starting to like become a big city. Anyway, if for me, that's one of the allures is just like the history aspect.
I'm with you.
Hey, Colin, when you say this is one of your favorite movies, is this like a top 20 movie for you?
It's hard to say if it's top 20. I would say it's top 50. Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely top 50 for me. I mean, this could almost be top 20. I'd have to think about it. I always say that, and then I have to sit down and write my list of top 20 movies.
That's the thing. It's really hard. There's a lot of competition.
Yeah.
Top 238 for sure.
Yes, it's definitely top 238.
Yeah. All right, so you guys want to talk cast?
Yeah.
So it is interesting that Kevin Spacey ends up being, I think he's the headliner here, technically, right, when they do the credits?
Yeah, and I think that's because the other two guys are relatively unknown, and he was like the biggest name. He had already won, I think, an Academy Award.
So how about the whole Spacey situation these days? Does that give you pause when you see him on screen? Does it change, you know, how you think about him and performance?
I think about it and I just try to think of like how much I love the performance and not how much of I love Kevin Spacey.
Right.
That's about it.
Yeah, I kind of got to do the same thing. I mean, you start working your way down the list of people that, you know, Mel Gibson, still big fan of The Road Warrior, but...
Yeah, you just kind of got to separate the two.
Yeah, so I think what's great about, so Spacey, Crow, and Pierce in this, all three of them have these characters that actually have some really interesting arcs to go through. So there's a lot of material for them to work with in the acting department, and they do a really great job, you know, sort of riding the emotional wave up and down as they're traversing this whole tale. So I think that's really good.
I got a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Who's your guy? Are you an Exley guy, a Bud White guy, a Jack Vincennes guy? Who's your man?
Like, who do I relate to, or who do I like the best?
Yeah, like, who do you like the best? Like,
how about this? If there's three of us, which one of us is Exley? Which one of us is Bud White? Which one of us is Kevin Spacey?
Another good question.
I don't know. They're all so complicated. I would say Exley would probably be my closest. Like, I'm not the muscle beating up guys. I'm not the Vincennes is just looking out for himself. Like, he's trying to do good, but as long as he's benefiting also. I guess Exley is the closest to like, okay, he's trying to do good, and also he's very similar to Vincennes in like motivation. but a little less corrupt.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'll just go Bud White.
You want to go beat up people and
casually execute people without a second thought?
I don't think he kills anyone, does he?
He shoots the guy right in the chest when he goes into the guy that was holding the girl in the apartment.
He knows he's the guy who knows how to answer those questions that Dudley posed to Ed.
Yeah, well, I'll have to talk about that.
Did the guy pull something on him? Like at the beginning you're talking about.
No,
he just staged it.
Yeah. Okay, well, how about Russell Crowe? What else do you want to say about Russell Crowe in this performance?
He's great. He's good.
I think I already said this is a really, really good performance. He's very intense. I love the scene in the interrogation room when he's already like on edge and then the kid starts talking about the woman. You see on his face, he just gets like more intense and more intense. And then just that shot of him like breaking the chair in his hands. I just love it. And then he just like, it's like he goes ballistic.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm a total Russell Crowe guy. I'm a Bud White guy. But I will say that I'm more like Ed Exley. I'm a rule follower, but that's the only way I'm like Ed Exley.
Yeah. I love Crowe's performance. I love his physical performance in this movie, the way he carries himself, because it seems like he's always just 2 seconds away from completely losing his shit. So he has just that great sort of undercurrent of the violence or anger that's just below the surface. And that shows up in a couple different places, right? One is where he gets out of the car in the beginning and kind of the way he's standing there, he's getting ready for the confrontation and he's really intense. And another one is when he's
pacing around almost like right at the beginning.
Yeah, he's like a caged tiger.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Like when he goes to Lynn Brackett's too and he's all fired up, he's doing that sort of that back and forth walk like a, you know, like a tiger, like a predator. I mean, he's pretty wound up. So I think his physical performance in this, I think, is really good.
Well, the same thing that happens at the very beginning. He goes down when they bring in the Mexicans in the jail. He actually goes down to stop his partner to like break up the fight and like, you know, avoid the issues. And then like when the guy says like, fuck your mother, then he's like, well,
it's on. Off.
He just starts joining in and beating everyone.
Yeah. He's short fused Bud White.
Yeah. Well, they had the great line. They had the great line to say, I think the captain says to Ed, best to stay away from a man when his blood is up. And Exley's response was, his blood is always up.
Yeah. His blood's up all the time.
He's like, he's just simmering the whole time. Yeah. He's just simmering. Waiting to go off.
How about Guy Pearce?
He's very calculated. I think he does a great job with the role too. He's very like believable in the role, and I think he does a wonderful job throughout like most of the scenes. I think the one that didn't work for me was with him and Kim Basinger. I think it's more about the motivations around the scene, and maybe it adds up later. But that was the one that it didn't quite fit.
Yeah, and that's the one of those scenes where I didn't really like his performance that much.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite scenes is in the police chief's office when he basically gives them a whole plan on how to resolve this scandal, the Bloody Christmas scandal.
Right.
And he makes his play for Detective Lieutenant, and he's just so great in that scene.
Yeah, he's calculating. I really like Guy Pearce as an actor. He's definitely an actor that if he's in a film, I will seek it out to watch it. How about you guys?
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I mean, this movie and then Memento, I thought he was amazing in that.
Did you ever see The Proposition?
No.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Or Ravenous?
No.
Oh, yeah, there's some good Guy Pearce movies out there for you to still see then, for sure.
Priscilla, the Queen of the Desert?
I have not seen that one, actually.
Yeah, it's really good, and it's got my man, General Zod, Terrence Stamp.
Apparently, Curtis Hanson did not want to watch that film prior to making the casting decision about Guy Pearce, because he thought he wanted Guy Pearce, and he did not want to be influenced after watching that film.
Probably a good idea. Yep. Very, very different performance.
I'm sure, yeah.
Didn't Guy Pearce play Peter Weyland of Weyland Enterprises?
Yes, he did. Yeah, of Weyland Yutani. Yeah, yeah. That was in Prometheus.
Yes, the fantastic Prometheus.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, I'm a Guy Pearce fan.
Yeah.
But of the Australians, Russell Crowe's, he's the one.
We all heard your man crush from the Gladiator podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
So you got James Cromwell. So he's in here as Dudley Smith. As far as I can tell, both James Cromwell and Danny DeVito, who's also in here as Sid Hutchins, both those guys, I think, hit a certain age and they just kind of stayed there. Because I'm pretty sure James Cromwell has been the same age for about 20 to 30 years. And I think maybe Danny DeVito, too.
I think Danny DeVito came out fully formed like that.
I think so, too.
It's like a Benjamin Button situation.
Well, you just sent that taxi clip the other day, and he looks exactly the same, and that's like 20 years before.
Yeah, he just has longer hair.
Yeah,
I know.
Did James Cromwell do an Irish accent through some of it? Like his yeah. accent seemed to come and go. Was he supposed to be Irish?
He's a cop. So yeah, he's supposed to be Irish. No, he wanted to do like an Irish dialect, and Curtis Hanson said, yeah, go for it. I think it makes sense personally. I think James Cromwell, he might be like sort of the backup MVP.
Yeah, he could have been nominated for supporting actor for sure.
Like, yeah, he gives a really great performance.
Oh, he's awesome in this movie.
Like, he's a linchpin, I think, to a lot of it, too. Like, setting it up and doing a lot.
Okay, so Kim Basinger. So we've talked about her, but really good performance. Marcus, I recall that I think you had used to have a thing for her back in the early 90s. I'm pretty sure.
Who didn't?
I didn't. No? You know, I was not a 9.5 weeks guy. I don't think I'd actually seen the movie.
Well, that's why you're not a 9.5 weeks guy.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, no, I was never a Kim Basinger guy, but when I saw this movie, I was like, holy shit. She's beautiful. Jesus.
Yeah, she's got definitely the classic. I mean, she plays a perfect role for her. She's got the classic Hollywood glamour, and like she's like the modern or 90s version of Marilyn Manson. And
Marilyn Manson?
Marilyn Manson. Marilyn Monroe.
God, I hope not.
As I was saying that, I'm like, wait, that's a wrong word.
Marilyn Monroe?
Marilyn Monroe. Like, she's got that. Or Veronica Lake.
Why don't we stick to Veronica Lake?
But she's got that classic Hollywood look, so.
Yeah, I really, really like this performance. And the character, too. I mean, the character's really well-written. I'm glad she won.
Yeah,
I like all the subtle stuff towards the end of the movie, too, how she adjusts her character. I really like the scene when she's sitting in the police station. And she's sitting there, and Exley comes in, and they have the exchange, and he says, you know, hey, are you doing okay? And then she's looking at him and says, how about you?
Yeah, exactly. Because
their faces are both that shape. I like that exchange. But I like at that point because I think the level of vulnerability she brings to the second part of the film in terms of her performance is really strong. It really feels like a well-formed character.
Yeah.
That's what I liked about, I mean, the whole movie, I think, does that really well. Like, all the characters are not surface level. They're, like, there's multifaceted in, like, across the board. They do a great job with it, I think. And that's what makes it so strong.
Yeah. That first scene where she meets Bud in her house, they have such strong chemistry together. And I really, really like that scene.
Yeah. The scene with Exley and her, we'll get to it, but that one comes across as forced. It's probably the worst scene in the movie overall, I think. Maybe the last person I mentioned on the cast is David Strathairn.
Who?
Love him. Love David Strathairn.
Yeah.
And he is so good at this role. I don't know. He's just like perfect, I think. He doesn't have a lot. And like towards the end, I feel like, you know, I wanted to see more of him. And I didn't like the way his character went. But I really liked him in this role.
Yeah. His delivery in this as somebody who is smooth, confident, and in control. Like when his first conversation he has with Bud White, I love that exchange. Like I could have watched another 3 to 4 minutes of just dialogue between the two of those guys because I think that scene is really great and it does a really good job for his character just in terms of, you know, authority. He doesn't feel under duress at all, even though the police are there, and he's just handling himself. He's handling his business as a character.
Totally. I think there's at one point like Exley confronts him. He says like, you know, we want answers. And he just like, sort of nonchalantly looks at him and says,
well, we all want something.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, the two I would mention, you didn't mention Lloyd Braun, who's fantastic.
I was wondering if Matt McCoy was going to come up.
Yeah. Lloyd Braun's a Seinfeld reference. He plays Brent Chase, the TV actor, but he's funny. Great to see him. And then also Simon Baker was a nice young role for him. He's another Australian, right?
Yeah,
he is. He played The Mentalist. We watched that show. But he's also on like Devil's Wear Prada and a couple other movies. So it was nice to see him. It was more of a surprise than any great role for him.
Is there anybody else from the cast you guys would like to mention?
Yes, one more person. Gwenda Deacon. She played Susan Leffert's mother.
It seems like my Susan. But my Susan was a blonde, not a redhead.
I just fucking love her.
She does a good job with it.
I love her voice and just everything about that character is so amazing.
And then who plays the district attorney? Because I know...
Oh, Ron Rifkin.
Yeah. So he's in a lot of stuff.
Yeah. He's an old character actor.
Amazing cast.
It is really a great cast, I have to say.
Yeah. Incredible cast.
Which is nice, too, because it wasn't like... It was early on for a lot of them, too. It probably wasn't that expensive of a cast because it was pretty early for many of the...
So now that you mention it, First of all, I want to give a shout out to Brian Helgeland, who wrote the screenplay with Curtis Hanson.
And also won the Academy Award for it with Curtis Hanson.
Yeah, yep.
The real DMC shout out from Colin is much higher in his book now than the
Academy. Congratulations, Brian. You've made it.
Do you know Brian Helgeland from anything?
He's the director of A Knight's Tale, isn't he?
Yep.
Among other films? Yes.
Yeah. I love that film, by the way. Maybe we should do that.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah. I'm a huge fan.
Anyway, when they were writing this, you know, they were shopping it. The studio, originally Warner Brothers didn't want to do it because it was period. All these reasons why they didn't want to do it. And they only had like a $15 million budget. And so that ultimately they were like, they don't have enough money to hire a bunch of movie stars for this, unless they did what the studio wanted, which is cut out like two of the three leads.
Right.
Then you could have a movie star, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we can't do that. So that's why they ended up like Kevin Spacey. He sort of gets top billing because he was like known. And then they basically got a couple of unknowns.
So Kevin Spacey won. He got his Academy Award the year before. So he probably, when he was shooting it, was probably
Wait,
still.
So what did he get it for? Because was it The Usual Suspects?
Unusual Suspects.
The Unusual Suspects.
Kaiser Soze.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen The Unusual Suspects.
That's the sequel.
Unusual Suspects. He won it for Usual Suspects as Kaiser Soze.
So okay, that's what I thought. And then Guy Pearce, I think this was his first American film, and then Russell Crowe had done like four or five movies in the US, so this was like old hat to him.
But it wasn't like he wasn't the star,
but he was not a big star, because what he did, like The Quick and the Dead, Virtuosity, I don't think I remember any of the other ones that he was in.
He's in Romper Snopper, but I think that's
Australian.
Which was distributed in the US, but was an Australian film. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why Curtis Hanson wanted him, because he just saw like that intensity in Bud White and thought he would be great for it.
All right. Well, you guys ready to just dive into this thing? Start going through it?
I guess so, man. Okay.
Let's do it.
Everybody strap in for the next 4.5 hours.
I have no quick summary.
I'll do it. As corruption grows in 1950s Los Angeles, three policemen, one straight-laced, one brutal, and one sleazy, investigate a series of murders with their own brand of justice.
That doesn't sound right.
That's from IMDb.
That's okay. All right, well, so the film opens, Mark has mentioned this before, but there is a fun voiceover during the credits. So I think the credit sequence for this film is actually really well done. And I like how when they're introducing the three main leads, their names are typed out on the screen. So you hear the sound of a typewriter with
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
What?
I love that too.
It's just like, it's a little thing, but it's very kind of, you know, kitschy, and it kind of puts you in the, you know, it sort of puts you in the period, I guess.
Yeah.
So and the usage like
the sound
of the typewriter. And the sound of the typewriter is great.
It's love it.
That's really cool.
I love the voiceover works really well. And it's Danny DeVito, and he's the reporter, the kind of tabloid reporter. And you get a lot of voiceover in like film noir. What I usually don't like about it, it's like the main character, and it ends up being a little bit cheesy. You get a little bit like I don't know, just a little parody of itself to a certain degree. And I think it works really well here with him as the tabloid reporter doing it, because it's not any of the main characters' voiceover. It's not kind of taking away. It's this other voice doing it. And I think it works really well with that.
Yeah, and Danny DeVito actually has a nice voice for this type of thing. Like he narrates The War of the Roses. So he's, you know, his voice works well for it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this and to see if you guys liked it, because I feel like I was sort of second guessing it, because I've seen it so often. But then I was like, well, the whole narration part, and they give you a lot of information, but they have to, right? And so the way they did it was quite good. Is it good? Is it still good? Like, do you still think it works? And I guess the answer is
yeah. Yeah, I think it works. Yeah. I think the voiceover, and I think like the use of newspapers and headlines and stuff like that, I think it's a nice way to kind of tie it, because it's also part of this story. So it's not gimmicky. He is a newspaper reporter and he is publishing this stuff, and it's part of the overall plot.
Yeah, it ends up being a nice vehicle to drop in elements of exposition along the way, where there's not a lot of additional setup that's required. So I think that works really well.
Yeah,
I think the other thing too is
the promotion and things like that.
Yeah, the fact that he's this kind of sleazy gossip magazine also, and since that's the opener, it's kind of setting up the reality of this Los Angeles and this era, and you know, there's corruption, there's, you know, there's a seedy underbelly that's in existence. And so I think the fact having him open that kind of sets the tone for the movie. So that's why I think it works really well.
They use this later in the film as well with Sid narrating some things that happen like behind the scenes or whatever.
Right.
And the way he does it, like as part of, you know, Hush Hush magazine, I think that's well done. So it's a good device for the narration.
Yeah. I also like the little vignettes because he sets up the story as if, okay, these characters, are they going to be doing, are they going to be making the next move? And then you just see the guys get gunned down. So that's, you know, that I think is kind of fun, right? So you get used to the fact that he is being, there's a little bit of misdirection that's taking place when those vignettes are happening.
Yeah.
So it does switch to, you get the Russell Crowe, Bud White introduction, and he's sitting in front of a house where he's watching through the window as a man is beating his wife. And just, you can just see he's just laser focused on it, the intensity. His partner doesn't want him to do anything about it. And then he gets out and, you know, pulls down the Christmas lights off this dude's roof and then basically just beats the shit out of him in a great intro. One thing I love about this movie is there are these little subtle actions that the characters take throughout the movie. And those little subtle actions do a lot to fill out their character. So one of them is, you know, after the woman comes out and he asks her if she has some place to stay and she's walking away, he holds up the Christmas lights for her so she doesn't have to duck under them. Just little things like that. So you get the sense that, you know, Bud is very interested in protecting and helping women. And you find out later in the movie why.
I love this scene a ton because you really get to know who this guy is. He does not like men who hurt women.
Yeah.
You know, and he's a very intense. The other guy is much bigger than him and he just like takes him out.
Right.
It's a really good scene.
Yeah. And then the other thing is it does set up that you see, or you meet Bud White's partner, Dick Stensland, who is sitting in the back, already drunk, you know, looks...
snickering in the back.
Yeah, snickering. You can tell this guy doesn't give a shit. Alcoholic burnout. Just he does... there in about 30 seconds, you kind of know who this character is. So that I think works really well. And then we switch to meeting Exley in the police station. This scene is fun too because so you meet Exley, so that's Guy Pearce's character, and I love the fact that this is how James Cromwell as the police captain is testing whether or not Exley has the balls to be a police officer. And he asked him if he would do two things: if he would, one, beat a confession out of a suspect that he knew was guilty, and the second one is would he plant corroborating evidence on a suspect, as if that's just like standard police procedure.
Yeah.
So and Exley says he won't do it, but I love that intro because right off the bat, you know, okay, the captain obviously has a very interesting whatever his line of morality is. It's definitely flexible. And Exley, of course, it gives him the opportunity to resist those taking those actions.
You forgot about shoot a hardened criminal in the back.
Oh, yeah, shoot a hardened criminal in the back, yeah. So
which is a little foreshadowing, by the way.
That is. That's how Dudley meets his end.
This is also one of my favorite scenes, just that part between them. You get to really know who Captain Dudley Smith is. This is your, like, introduction to the old school policing, right? Which is... beating
brutal
confessions out of suspects and, you know, planting evidence and all this shit. And then essentially the vanguard of the new LAPD, which is Exley. And, you know, their ethics are like night and day.
Yep.
And I also just fucking love the line.
At least get rid of the glasses. I can't think of a single man in the bureau who wears them.
Right. So the other thing that happens after this, so then you meet to, or you switch to Jack Vincennes. So you find out, so Kevin Spacey's character, Jack Vincennes, working with Danny DeVito, and they've planned sort of a sting operation on an actor. So they can actually catch him in the act of smoking marijuana, and they stage it so that there's a movie premiere behind them when, you know, and it's actually really funny because, you know, he leads them out, he pauses, the press take the shot, and then Vincennes takes this guy away. I like that scene a lot because it really sort of sets the tone as to the relationship between DeVito and Spacey. You also, you know, you kind of see Vincennes. At that point, he's not really struggling with his actions. He's pretty much just all in on it. But it kind of sets it's the starting point for the Vincennes arc, right? Because he's going to get paid $50 to basically, you know, have this guy captured in the act of smoking marijuana. And apparently, I didn't know this, but this is based on a very famous Robert Mitchum arrest that was captured in a Gossip magazine. For marijuana? I didn't realize that. But that was when they set up the shot or the picture. I guess that's what they based it on.
Oh, they've even referenced that in the movie.
Oh, did I miss that? I must have missed it.
Yeah. This is pretty awful, setting up these actors. But I do love how when Jack makes the bust, he like just nonchalantly like breaks through the window, opens the door and says, freeze, police.
Freeze! Police!
Right. Yeah. not a lot of constitutional protection underway in terms of policing in this film.
I love the voiceover too. No. Potheads on the prowl for marijuana. This is the whole Danny DeVito setup of it. Just so like 50s tabloid. It's just great.
Yeah, the dialogue they give him is pretty cool. Actually, it's very poetic. So then this switches to the first kind of the first big element of conflict.
It's Christmas Eve in the City of Angels.
And 12 terrorists have taken over. Got confused. It was Los Angeles. So they go back to the police station and they're having the Christmas Eve party with the police. And Bud White had stopped to pick up some alcohol. And this is where you see Bud White. He actually meets Kim Basinger's character for the first time. So Lynn Brackett. And he sees another woman who is sitting in the back seat of a car and she has a bandage on her nose. And he kind of gets keyed in on that. In terms of thinking, okay, it's another woman who maybe has been beaten, so he takes an interest. But and this is the first time you meet Pierce Patchett, who's played by David Strathairn. So that scene's good because it just reinforces Bud White's intensity in terms of protecting women, and it also I think it's nice because it kind of gives the Lynn Brackett character and Kim Basinger's character there's a certain level of independence or strength that I think she projects in that first scene.
Yes, it's Bracken, by the way.
Oh, Bracken.
Yeah.
Oh, I keep thinking of Sheriff Brackett from Halloween.
You don't realize until much later in the film, it's such a pivotal scene in like bringing people together. And like, because that's where you meet Meeks, the ex-police officer, and there's a couple other, like, ends up being a scene that ties things together greatly.
Yeah, you do meet one character who ends up being a corpse underneath the house later in the movie.
But also, well, two corpses, actually, yeah. Because Susan Lefferts is in the car.
Oh, yeah.
So he recognizes her.
Or three, because Dick Stenslin is there, too. Stenslin.
Everybody dies. Well,
also four, because Pierce also dies. Everyone but Lynn and Bud die in that scene.
By the way, apparently the body count in this movie is 30. You don't really think that, but
I'm not surprised.
But it is. I mean, 30 people get killed in this movie, so it's definitely...
And
there's a lot of people getting killed. All I have to say is Dudley is tying up loose ends.
And if you weren't aware, there will be spoilers in this podcast. If you're an hour in and...
Yeah. Also, the movie's been out for like 25 years. So if you haven't watched it by now...
So at the police station, they bring in some suspects who they believe either... I think they beat a couple police officers. And there are... it's like seven Hispanics that they bring down to... the jail cells. And apparently this was based on a real event. Did you know that?
No.
So it happened in Christmas, but there were seven Hispanics that were, you know, reported in a white part of town. The police came down and picked them up and then brought them back to the jail cells. This really happened. And then they were beaten, but it didn't come out around Christmas. It came out months later.
I'm sure it's happened.
I'm so not surprised.
I'm sure it's happened more than once. Like, I'm not...
Oh, yes. No, I mean, this was so... I think it was framed on a real incident. Might be a better way to say it. A couple takeaways, though, from that. The Christmas party at the police station.
Oh, man. I almost did a spit take.
I love how much alcohol they're putting in the punch, by the way, because, like, they cut at one point to Dick Stenslin, who just has, like, two full bottles just upended. He's just dumping them in. So, like...
Oh. So can we just talk about that?
How are any of those cops going to get anywhere at the end of the night? I mean, that's a lot of alcohol.
So the uniform cop who's there as Dick is, like, pouring these bottles into the punch bowl. I'm like, is it really even punch at this point?
No.
But he's there, and he's, like, kind of teetering, and he's, like, slurring his words, talking about how... You know, like one detective lost an eye and they're reading the other one his last rites.
Yeah.
That guy might be my backup MVP in this movie. he plays drunk really well.
He does.
He may have actually been drunk.
Well, it's interesting too, because actually at that point, it's trying to explain. It's like, no, they're just home. They have like a couple of band-aids. It wasn't like serious.
Oh, yeah. They have bruises and muscle pulls. And they're like, and the cops exaggerating are just like on a rampage. Yeah. I love how actually. He's like, you're all going in my report.
And then they lock him in the closet.
And then they lock him in a closet like it's like some tattletale.
Yeah.
Which is...
Oh, and the other thing that happened earlier, so Vincennes did show up for the party and he was going to give $10 to Exley as part of the payoff. And Exley decided not to take it. By the way, I looked up rate of inflation on this. So it's about it's about 10 times the value. So the $50 that Vincennes gets to do his dirty deeds would be about $500 today.
Thank you. I was wondering that.
Yeah. So that's how much he's getting paid for each one of these Hush Hush magazine incidents. Yeah. So big brawl erupts. And this is, we talked about a little bit, but everybody's just beating on everybody. cops get busted for it. Colin already mentioned Exley going in and cutting the deal, and sort of, you know, it's a really great scene where with the district attorney, he kind of tells him, hey, this is how it should go down. And I don't know, I do like how Guy Pearce is kind of holding Exley sort of, you know, ramrod straight when he's walking through the halls. And, you know, he has a certain cockiness for knowing the fact that like every cop in the department's going to be hating on him, and he still is just charging ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Like he knows. And oh, shit, there was one line in there. I think Dudley was saying, you know, you're going to be hated by every cop, you know, in this department. Are you willing to take that risk? And he's like, yes. Yeah. Yes, I am.
Yep.
Yeah, he's totally squared away, and he's working his way to the top as quickly as he can.
Yeah. Yeah, he's ambitious to the core. He definitely, like, that's one of his defining character traits for sure.
Here's a little Curtis Hanson thing. I love how they're in the brawl of the jail cell, and they take a picture, and it's freeze frame on this black and white picture of the brawl, and then that, and they pull back, and it's the newspaper. Yeah. Yeah. And that the chief is holding up. Really,
I think he does that a couple of times.
Great transition.
Yeah, great transitions.
It also smooths out. Like, you don't have to, like, it makes it more of a serial. Like, it's just different scenes coming in and out. And so you don't have to have that big transition, which it's also how the movie, like, a lot of them are just scenes. You're like, okay, how does this tie into anything? Or how does, like, each of these threads do get started? And they don't have any sense of connection at all.
Right. These characters don't, like, really have any interaction with each other up until, you know, this point in their careers. They know of each other. I think Exley just knows that Bud White's a thug, a mindless thug. And he knows, you know, Vincennes is the technical advisor on Badge of Honor. And basically, is he even a cop anymore? Or is he just, like, a sort of a celebrity slash Hollywood cop?
He was on Vice, I think.
Yeah. So they've got reputations. And I think they all know he's a, you know, a climber. That X is a climber.
College boy. But,
well, I do like, though, because when Vincennes, he actually, as part of the punishment for participating in the riot, he gets transferred to Vice. And I do like the opening scene where the captain is pulling out some pornography, and he's saying that this pornography is being produced, and then he has a line, something, the quality ranges from piss poor to pretty good. I thought that was pretty funny. So he's reviewing the pornography. But then I also really like that scene because this is where Vincennes finds the first reference to the fleur-de-lis, which is the service that is serving up these prostitutes that look like actresses. And I like the fact that he can't, even though he's sort of burned out and his moral compass is definitely out of whack, he's still a detective, right? Because he finds that and he gets a little bit interested, and he takes note of it. And so I do like the fact that as his character, the whole cop part of him is not truly dead. There's a little bit there.
Right. And it's fun to see him work the leads and get out the reverse lookup. And it's pretty
He actually does some police work. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the other thing that happens around this time is Exley is at night working the homicide division, and a call comes in because there's been a murder. And one of the things I think is great about here on the characters.
Oh, you missed a huge.
What?
He had the Mickey Cohen's old lieutenants are being either killed off, and the out-of-town gangsters are being run out of town. They have a couple of vignettes of, I think that happens before the Night Owl.
Right.
The 25 pounds of H is stolen.
Yeah, so there is a moment where they reference the fact that some heroin has gone missing, which will play a part towards the end of the film. Yeah, thanks, Marcus, for calling back to that, because there is a moment where Captain Dudley sits down with Bud White, so Russell Crowe's character, and he's asking him to help him on this special assignment. And Bud White's initially kind of excited because maybe he thinks, oh, I get to work cases in homicide because he's going to be transferred to homicide. What he's actually going to be doing is transferred to the goon squad so he can just go beat the shit out of people for Dudley. So that's the plan. But one of the lines that Captain Dudley has is he's complimenting Bud White, and he says,
I admire you as a policeman, particularly your adherence to violence as a necessary adjunct to the job.
It's that's a good line. So you can just tell that James Cromwell's Captain Dudley is very, very comfortable with corrupt actions, violence, just sees violence as an everyday tool of the trade, and actually has a quality that is beneficial to being an effective police officer.
The other thing I like about that scene is that Bud had been suspended, and so Dudley gives him back his gun and badge, and he, like, practically leaps out of his seat to grab them and put them back. It's like he doesn't know how to do anything other than to be a
cop.
It's
so much tied to his identity.
Well, and that's why they do that, and then relatively close to that is where Exley is in working by himself late night at homicide, and a call comes in.
Yeah.
And I love how Exley knocks a lamp over, like, in a frantic run to get to the the radio, so he can be the one to take the call. Like, he really, really wants to do it. So that enthusiasm, I think, is pretty funny. And so, you know,
by the way, that scene in the Homicide Detectives Bureau, that's another one where I think the production design is really, really good. You just feel like you're in the 1950s, like the way that room looks and feels.
Yeah, no, the set design is fantastic. And all the, I mean, phones, file cabinets, lights, the flooring. I mean, it just all looks so, it's so immersive of an experience when you're watching this movie.
Yeah, and one of the other things about it is that it's not done to death. It's not intricate. There's not details everywhere. In fact, there's like almost a lack of details. They did that on purpose because they were watching like a lot of these old movies from the 50s and TV shows from the 50s. And they were very sparsely decorated sets. And it totally works. It's great.
So Exley does go to this place called the Night Owl. He finds a bunch of dead bodies. One other moment that's really funny from a character standpoint is at one point, the press comes up to him, and he's talking to the captain, and then he turns, and he changes his whole sort of appearance for a second, you know, his countenance. He's like, okay, like, I'm the cop, and then he goes back to talking to the captain. So I like Exley's.
Oh, you mean when they pose for the photo? Exactly.
I love those little moments. So they switch back to the police station, and one of the things they're doing is they bring in the mom to identify. What's her name? What's the character's name?
Susan Lefferts.
So Susan Lefferts is being identified. One thing that threw me here is that I don't know if you guys noticed, but she moves her eye when she's laying on the table.
I didn't notice.
And it's distracting. Her eyelashes flutter for a second when she's laying on the table.
You sure it wasn't like just a little bit of like a breeze, or was it when they were?
I don't know. There's a lot of breezes going through a closed room.
Well, when they moved the sheet or something.
I don't think so. I'll have to go back and look at it, but
I've never. Yeah,
I thought
that
was interesting because I even like at that point in my notes I did write down like because I totally forgot like what happened. I'm like, oh, like the mom can't identify her own daughter because she's blonde now, not a redhead, or the other way around. I guess she's a redhead now and not blonde.
Well, and she had some facial reconstruction.
Well, you don't find that out until later. So they kind of tie it together nicely to say like, oh, like how come she doesn't recognize her own daughter? And then they find out later that she did have the surgery.
So this is the scene, though, that where I have some questions about how this ties back to an action that Bud White takes later in the movie, right? Because he's there watching the identification process taking place.
Yeah, because he came to the morgue because he found out that Dick had been shot. Right.
So what's the question?
Well, so later in the film, when Bud White goes to talk to the coroner and he gets the name of this woman, suddenly it's as if that's the first time he's heard it. So that's the question I have, which is, how did he not know that that was the woman? Or what's the piece of information that changes when he's talking to the coroner? Because he's actually there for the identification. So it seems like the name is what triggers him into action when you watch the scene when he's talking to the coroner. And so that's the one thing that just didn't really track for me.
Because he found out it's Stenslin's girlfriend later.
As I was rewatching the movie, this was the point that hit me as like a plot point that I found very confusing, which is later in the film, so Bud White goes back and he's talking to the coroner.
He's looking at the crime scene photos. Stenslin probably fought back.
Yeah, because there's blood on the wall.
Right, so he finds out that Stenslin was hit.
No, because he didn't know who she was with. So, right, he saw the lipstick on the cup.
So he knew, that someone was with
him. Yeah, so he was sitting at the seat. The coffee cup had lipstick on it.
Yeah, and he said one of the victims was a woman. Her name's Susan Lefferts.
But Susan Lefferts was there and was dead because he was participated in the identification. So why is that new news to him?
She wasn't interesting to him then. He didn't know it was his girlfriend. Like, it wasn't interesting that he's like, okay, this girl got shot. Wait, this girl was sitting with my partner? Now that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm still not 100% sure that it works. So we can skip past all
no,
this
I think,
shit.
I think the interesting
out,
part, though, is because she was with Dick. Because I think that's a part with it. Like, he sees the lipstick on the cup.
I guess my question is, so if the crime scene happened and Dick Stenslin is there and he knows that Dick was probably there with meeting somebody.
He didn't know that, though.
And
he just thought it was a place that Dick went for a cup of coffee, not meeting anyone, not nothing. Because they did say Dick was a regular at the coffee shop.
Maybe it's more the finding out that there was a coffee cup sitting across from the head
exactly
with lips on it.
Is. And saying, like, wait a minute, why is this lady connected to Dick? And then he's piecing together, like, wait, why did he lie to
all
me?
Right, okay. I guess it works. Yeah. I didn't seem to be.
Because remember, then he saw her in the car. Yeah, he lied to me about not knowing her in the car. He lied to me about Meeks. He lied.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Right? Okay. Thank you. Question satisfied. Okay. All right. So then getting back to the film progression. So Bud White does go meet Kim Basinger for the first time. And what's great about that is that she is in there entertaining somebody, one of her clients. And that's actually a really funny moment. It's a great casual exchange because, you know, she's you know, portraying a movie that has Veronica Lake in it, and this guy's wearing the fedora like he's, you know, they're kind of acting out the movie or something along those lines. And then Bud White knocks on the door, and what does he say to him again? He's like,
LAPD shitbird.
LAPD shitbird.
Now get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here. I'll call your wife to come and get you.
Because I love that, because the guy initially is like, you want me to get rid of him, doll, or whatever?
Yeah, he's being and all then, tough. And like,
he's being all tough. And then as he walks past, the great thing is, you know, Bud White goes, see you around, councilman, or something like that. Yeah.
Right. Officer, councilman.
I just like that. The other thing I noticed in this scene is that she offers him a drink, and it's like a half a glass of scotch. Man, how many shots? So all these guys are just rolling around town, like drinking like seven
people
or eight shots,
back
man.
Then, they
have you seen Mad Men?
You know, they also used to smoke.
There's not much smoking in this, huh?
Oh, is there any? Is there's not much smoking in this.
I didn't think of it.
Funny. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So next, they bring in the three suspects for the Night Owl murders.
Right, so they I forget how they get the tip. Oh, so they're searching for a certain car, a Mercury.
Yeah, this is where I think you don't have, like, there's things going on behind the scenes that you don't know about. And that's what I think makes it really interesting. Like, okay, like, you don't.
Because when you learn about it later and you think back to the scene, you're like, oh, they weren't finding shotguns. They were planting shotguns.
Yeah, so Exley and Vincennes get there, and there are two cops already there, and you find out that those two are, you know, they're in the bag for Captain Dudley. You find that out later. But there are three shotguns in a car, so they go up and they raid a residence, and this leads to, there is one great moment where, you know, Exley is kind of there. He wants to take command, and the other two cops are there, and Vincennes has this great line. He's like, he's very serious. He's talking about Exley. And I thought that was...
Oh, I thought he was talking about the other...
No, he's talking about Exley to the two other cops.
Yeah.
Because the other guy was really serious.
I just like the Kevin Spacey energy in that moment is great. Kevin Spacey's for a while is kind of sort of gliding through this film in a slightly different reality than some of the other characters.
He feels like he's because he's a celebrity.
Yeah, he's like a celebrity cop.
And that's what he feels like.
Freeze, police.
Yeah it's all cool. But hey.
Well, also when they bust in, this is when Exley, they immediately almost shoot the guy at the very beginning and Exley like hit the officer's gun so he doesn't kill him immediately. When they bust...
Another thing where you're like, now it makes sense, right?
Like they're going to go in and just shoot all three of them and be done.
Yeah, they're just going to kill them.
Yeah, there's a lot about this that now it all makes sense. Like, how did they escape? They're like locked up. How did they escape? Well, because they actually like probably let them out.
The one question I had about this is after they do end up going to the one house that the guy gave up, and that's where they end up finding him. That was like the one that didn't seem...
Oh, when they go to Roland Navarrete's house?
Yeah. But why would they go to that house? Because that's the only one address that they gave up at that time.
Because Exley knew that that's where they bought their drugs. So he was thinking, okay, where might they go? They're not going to go home because we know where they live. Yep. Well, the only other place I know is that.
No, I understand why the police went there, but why would the suspects go there? You're just talking to the police.
They were just, they couldn't go home and they probably wanted to get high.
Are you going to give them? Okay, you just got busted. You just escaped jail. Is your first instinct one to get high?
I want to get high.
And two, are you going to go to the one address that you gave the police during interrogation? Like, it seems unlikely.
There might be a logic problem there.
Yeah. But that's the one that
I don't know that they're like really smart. They're not really smart criminals either. That.
But this is where they had tied up and raped a girl. And this is where Bud White does shoot the guy who was watching that house. So that was the one.
Yeah, I like that.
That was the one flaw in the corruption plan, which is kind of an interesting twist.
What's the flaw?
The police are trying to set up these three guys, but they've tied up and raped this girl, which gives them an alibi. Yeah. Not a great alibi. That ends up being if they didn't know about that before, right? So they then try to corrupt the witness and say the timing could have worked.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, when they interviewed her, quite clearly they were just going to say, she told us that.
They were going to coach her on that to get the information they needed.
Yeah, obviously they were not thinking that that was going to play a part in it at all. That was just like a surprise.
Yeah, I think that's what, they didn't know about her at all.
But their whole point was that they're going to pin it on these three guys, kill them in the process. And that's like when Exley stopped him, the first guy, from shooting him the first time they caught them. You foiled our plan. Now, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to interrogate them. And then we'll figure something out. Like, we will let them easily escape. Now we have a second chance to go out and kill them. And that's exactly what ends up happening, except Ed unwittingly participates in that. and becomes Shotgun Ed.
No, and what's great about that too is the captain, now knowing what you know and looking back at that scene, how congratulatory and happy the captain is, because he's like, oh, excellent, you just solved my problem for me. Thank you.
Yeah. And it was kind of interesting too, because I thought, so when you're watching it the first time, the detective, you know, the detective that went with him, who volunteered to go with him to Roland Navarrete's house, he's the same detective who was like planting the shotguns, but you didn't know that at the time. And so when Exley was looking for someone to help him go and this guy volunteers, I thought, oh, look at that. He's earning some respect within
the department. I thought he did earn, like during the interrogation, because he's the one who leads the interrogation of the three suspects.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then this was like a concrete display of him earning that respect. Now this guy wants to go with him because he's like, I think he might be onto something. That's not why he went with him. He went with him to make sure that these guys died. And he gets killed in the process, which I thought was ironic. Yeah, and I think
this section of the movie really like is so critical because it also brings out Bud White. This is the interrogation. I think, Dave, you talked about it earlier, where he goes busting into the interrogation room and he does Russian roulette with the guy and shoves it in his mouth to get the address of the girl.
Right.
Also, Exley's trying to, he doesn't believe this story. That's when the seeds of doubt start getting kind of sown. He's like, wait, what these guys are talking about, none of this really adds up. This doesn't seem to make sense. And so I think that's when you start to see there's something else going on. And that's when like it all starts to kind of unravel in a sense, I thought.
Yeah, I do love Guy Pearce during the interrogation scene. Yeah.
Oh, that's
a great
scene.
The intensity of Exley like going in and just kind of coming, going right at these guys and laying it out and using the, you know, the cross room radio communication to get them to turn on each other and all that. I just, the way that that's orchestrated and the speed at which he's moving and the intelligence is all very effective.
Yeah, because you can see there's like, I don't know how many 50 guys in that anteroom, you know, waiting for this interrogation to go down. And there's Exley like sort of calmly like reviewing files, like figuring out how he's going to approach this. And then he goes in and he just masterly interrogates these guys. And you're like, wow, like he really is smart. He's really good.
I love the cross suspect knowledge. Like, oh, like let me play out what he's saying to the other person. And like that works well in any interrogation where they're giving up each other. At least they think they're giving up each other.
Also, you know, he says at one point when he's like leaving the room to go talk to another guy, he's like, you know, I've been sitting here talking to you for 5 minutes here. You've never asked once why you're here. And now you're thinking about it, you're like, yeah, because like they didn't do anything.
Well, that's they're also why. Guilty of the girl too. So that one guy was scared.
Well, there is that. So I don't think they kidnapped and were holding the girl. It was like the other guy
Bud kills.
I think, you know, they'd gone there, but they didn't do it. They weren't holding her. So I don't think they were really sweating that. It makes sense.
Now. Well, then after this is kind of interesting because this sort of, I think what you're talking about is it's the first and second part of the film, right? Because for all intents and purposes, you know, they have the perps that they thought committed the Night Owl killings. They have them. It's, you know, it's over. But of course, Exley is unsatisfied with it. Vincennes is unsatisfied. Bud White actually grows to become unsatisfied. And so what is interesting here is they also, there's a real quick flip that shows actually, the fact Vincennes that you have... You know,
Vincennes didn't have a problem at this point. He didn't get interested until...
until the actor.
Yeah, until the... What was the name? Matt, I think, was the character. Yeah, he didn't realize any of this was tied together at that point.
Yeah, so I guess Exley is the one right now who primarily is feeling a little bit uncomfortable with the whole situation.
You also have Exley and Bud basically squaring off. When they rescued the girl, you know, they have this confrontation and Bud almost like rips Exley's head off, right? They're all like holding.
Well, that's
back.
Why when they go to the house, so they've Bud now like they, goes in there. Give me 1 minute or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And Dudley, like I think he was like, oh yeah, okay, do your thing because that's exactly what we would want.
Just go murder the guy.
You know, kill the guy, and then we'll clean
it's
up.
It's a lot easier to not have a trial.
Just to go back to that scene too, I do really like when Russell Crowe is going through the house very quietly, and he gets to the woman, and she's tied up, and I love how she uses her eyes to guide him in the direction where the guy is. I just that whole filmmaking, that moment, I thought was really well done.
Totally agree. And that's also why this is one of my favorite scenes in the film. There's a lot of favorite scenes in the first half of this movie. There's a lot of exposition and like things sort of happening in the second half that are very much plot oriented and character oriented, but there's really good scenes in the first half.
Again, the movie is wrapped up at this point in terms of the crime. Of course it's not, but that's a little bit the way that they're pitching it because it cuts to, it shows Pierce Patchett and he's involved in building the Santa Monica Freeway. So you still know that there's something going on. What they're really showing you is this is the activity that Captain Dudley is involved in terms of taking control of crime across the city. There is one nice moment too. So Bud White goes back to Kim Basinger's apartment, and they end up having a conversation. And I thought this was really neat. Like, she takes him into her actual room as opposed to the room that she uses to sleep with clients, right? So she kind of shows who she is. She's a little bit more vulnerable. She shows, like, the Arizona pillow, for example, to him. So I just like that. I like their relationship, and I think the chemistry between the two of them is really good.
Right. And you know it's real at that point. She's letting him into her inner sanctum, and they have a genuine connection. He's not a John.
And then from here, so Marcus referenced it, but this is where Vincennes is then getting paid to set up. What they're trying to do is they're trying to catch, ultimately it's going to be the district attorney in the process, right? That's what Hush Hush Magazine is going for. That's what their target is. And so
DeVito has a line, the DA's swish. And so they try and set him up with the actor Matt. And so then they end up getting the pictures, but then Matt dies, which they don't know. At that point, it just seems like, okay, what happened with that? It's very confusing.
Well, so I do have a question about that scenario, though, because so Hush Hush Magazine is going to pay Vincennes to show up at midnight to, you know, presumably catch him in the act of having sex with the DA. But was the actual intent going to be that they wanted him to find the murder? Was that the plan all along?
I don't know.
That's an open question because...
Maybe because I guess... So the question is, did they kill Matt Reynolds? Was that the plan all along, or did something go wrong? And he was, you know, because he was very nervous about the whole thing. And maybe he was saying that he was just going to go to the police and tell them.
They explained it.
But then they...
Yeah, because he overheard them bribing. So, right?
Oh, okay. So then they just called an audible and killed
Dudley
him.
Wanted to get the DA on board with the whole corruption and all of that. DA refused to go along with it. And so then Matt, the actor, heard them trying to bribe him. And so that's when they ended up killing him.
Okay.
Does that make sense? So I think they didn't necessarily want to kill him.
Right. That was not the plan.
By the way, I'm not sure they did kill him because apparently I have an obsession now with looking at dead actors on screen and seeing if they're alive, because this guy is still clearly alive. You can see the pulse in his throat as he's laying there. I'm serious, man. Like,
wow. I'm speechless.
I thought maybe initially, I know this guy's dead because I've seen this movie before, but when I was rewatching it, I'm like, are they trying to say that he might be in the lingering stages of life? I mean, the last stages of his, as he's bleeding out and Vincennes is watching it happen.
Here's my question, Dave. Why are you so intently looking at his throat wound?
I don't know, but... I'm telling you, man, I can fire this thing up right now and it's moving, but
I'll go back and look at it later. But I've seen it a million times and I've never noticed.
You know, I'm going to just fire the fucking thing up right now just to prove it to you.
No, it does. Okay. Just keep going. Just keep going.
So Vincennes uses this moment to grow a conscience, right? So he has his $50 that he got to set this whole thing up. And before he finds the guy dead, he's sitting in the bar. And he has a moment of clarity in terms of conscience, or a moment of conscience, I should say. So he ends up leaving the $50 that he was given, and he ends up rushing back to the motel to try and stop this guy from getting caught in the act. But of course, that's when he sees the dead body. So ultimately, it's a nice moment for Vincennes because it's the start of him having a conscience, and it basically sets the direction for his character for the rest of the film.
All right, hold on a second.
Oh, shit, you're right. Holy shit.
Right?
Well, now that I was looking at it.
Okay. Yeah, dude's still alive. Thank you.
Well, no, he's dead, but it's just that, unfortunately, they couldn't actually kill Simon Baker to get dedication.
Simon Baker has no heart, dude. He should have gone full method for that.
No, the problem is that he has heart and it's pumping.
So the other thing is, Bud White does, so he starts dating Lynn. Good segue. And then this is where...
I think you're totally wrong on Susan Lockhart.
All right, we're moving on, Colin.
I'm one for two on my dead bodies not being dead. Okay.
All right.
So the other thing that is interesting is this is where, so Bud White starts dating Lynn, and you actually finally get the backstory as to why Bud White wants to protect women. And it's an uplifting story about how his dad tried to attack his mom, he got in the way, he got stabbed, and then his...
Uplifting story about a man in handcuffs, a lead pipe... And a radiator.
His dad chained him to the radiator, and then he sat there as his dad beat his mom to death with a tire iron, and then his dad just took off, and so somebody found him 3 days later. Let me just say that it's good that Bud White channeled all this into becoming a police officer, because it could be the Joker origin story or something like that.
I'm thinking serial killer, definitely. I mean,
that is a rough upbringing, so yeah. Sorry, Bud, that's a tough one. Good story, though. Good good justification for his character's actions. You kind of understand why he might take issue with men that beat on women. Yeah.
Then he smacks Lynn. It's like bad move, he does. Bud. Jesus.
And then right around this time too, so this is where Exley is unsatisfied. He wants to keep kind of digging on the Night Owl, and he goes and he actually asks Vincennes for some help. And this is a great exchange between the two of them in the office, because one of the things that Vincennes does is he looks at Exley and he says, "Lieutenant," in a very, you know, sort of just dripping with, like, you know, yeah.
Derisive manner.
It's very aggressive, sarcastic. It's a, you know,
what he was asking, pejorative. Like, why would you want to dig into this, Lieutenant?
Yeah, because this is what got your promotion, asshole. Yeah. That's what he's saying.
Exactly. Yeah. You got promoted because of it. So why are you going to dig it up? But the two of them do team up. Like, I'll help you with your case, you help me with mine. And
yeah, it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, because the back and forth between the two of them, I think, is really well done. And also you end up getting, it actually advances both of their characters during that conversation, because when he's talking to Vincennes and he says, "Hey, why did you become a cop?" And, you know, Vincennes has this great line. He says, "I don't remember," right? Which is like, he's kind of at the end of his rope and he recognizes his moral compass is off course and all that. So that's great. And then you also get the story that Exley tells about his dad being killed by a purse snatcher. And he gives him the name Rollo Tomasi. I had a question as to, and Colin, maybe this came up in the documentary, how did they end up with Rollo Tomasi as the made-up name?
Is that a made-up name?
What are we talking about?
Is it a made-up name? But is it like someone, I thought it was the actual person in the 50s or something.
No. No, they did not talk about where they came up with the name Rollo Tomasi, but they did say that is an invention of the screenplay. It is not in the book.
Oh,
there is no reference to Rollo Tomasi in the... They were having a lot of trouble with, I guess, some of the plot details, and this is the way they were able to solve it.
I do love that device of only two people know the information. So then when the captain uses that information, it's like...
And I think that's what it was. Or like, how do we get it so that Exley becomes suspicious of Captain Smith? And
it's
and
a great, great mechanism, because you're in on it.
Yeah, it's really smart. Yeah, because when he says that as he's dying, you're just like, wait, why is he doing that? And then, like, the next scene, Dudley's like, find out who this Rollo Tomasi is. And it's like, what? The look on Ed's face.
I was going to say, that's the one thing about that scene.
Was just like, I was thinking that Dudley was going to be like, oh, because why did your face just go
right? If Dudley's supposed to be this great cop, that is one thing I think is pretty funny, is, you know, Guy Pearce's face is like, you know the name. So it's kinda, I think the captain was a little bit, I think the captain was taking a few minutes off of being a policeman at that point. So, and then another thing that's kind of funny is there's a great moment where Exley and Vincennes are doing the investigation, and they go to talk to Johnny Stepanato, and they go in and they assume that he's with a woman
who is
supposed to be a hooker, that's supposed to look like Lana Turner, and such it actually is Lana Turner. And Exley's kind of like saying, "I'm going to take you downtown," all this kind of stuff. She's looking at him like, "Who the fuck are you?" And it's this great back and forth.
LAPD, sit down.
Who in the hell do you think you are?
Take a walk, honey, before I haul your ass downtown.
You are making a large mistake.
Get away from our table.
Shut up. A hooker cut to look like Lana Turner is still a hooker.
Hey!
She just looks like Lana Turner.
She is Lana Turner.
What?
She is Lana Turner.
That's a great moment, the Kevin Spacey leaning in and saying, "That is Lana Turner." I love that exchange. That's so much fun.
It's like one of the great funny scenes in the movie.
Which is too bad. Not too bad, but like that scene wasn't, I don't think they get any info out of that scene, right? It ends up being a useless scene. It has that joke in it, but it's funny.
I thought doesn't he reference the heroin in that scene or not?
I don't know. I don't think so. Because it's really just all about, because it's perfectly set up, right? Hookers who are cut to look like movie stars. And here's Johnny Stompanato with... You know, he's not even thinking like this could actually be a real movie star. It's really a wonderful moment. So apparently this was also not in the book. They came up with
this. That's what it feels like. It does feel like they had this great bit. Like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if they...
And then Brian Helgeland said that he's pretty sure that James Ellroy like really wishes that he had added it to the book, like that he had come up with it himself.
It is a good one. I wish they got a little info out of it though, because that was the one thing I think it didn't work as well. Like it wasn't.
I don't care because it's just such a great scene. Exley gets taken down a peg or two.
The one question I had though was, why did Bud go back to look up more on the United? Why did he go back to look at the photos?
he's doing police work. That's what you do. You like you go back.
No, but
you
why look at the case? The Night Owl case was closed. So why did he get interested in it again?
Oh, like why was he
interested? He finds Meek's body before he goes back to the coroner.
No, but doesn't he find Meek's body.
No, he doesn't go to. He doesn't.
No,
go
but
to
the why corner. Does he? He finds Meek's body.
That's at Mrs. Lefferts. No,
but before that,
and he goes there because of yeah, Susan that's Lefferts.
Before that, he looked at the photos
when he was.
Why was he looking at the photos?
Yeah, because he was. Was he investigating Stensland's photo?
Oh, you still wanted to figure out like why was Stensland there?
So I think so. I don't know. I don't what.
I think he also like they all sort of thought that you know the three that it was just like it was something fishy about it.
So he just thought and then like okay, yeah. Stensland fought back the blood on the wall, and so then he's like looking at the photos and like
yeah, and then he's like
something's not adding up.
Like so he was with somebody because he was supposed to meet him right, and then he's like oh no,
he's supposed to meet who?
Well, he wanted to hook up with Stensland later that night, and then Stensland said no, I got a date. This is like right after he got fired. And then he ends up dead.
So he just had the nagging question. Okay, how did he end up dead? How did this? Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
So one other quick historical note. So apparently Johnny Stampinato was a real person, and he was stabbed to death by Lana Turner's daughter, which I didn't realize because he was beating her.
Yeah.
And
you can't.
And apparently there was a trial, and it was a big sensation. I didn't know any of that. So.
But they did not meet until 1957, and this takes place in 1953.
So, and this is where Exley goes to...
Dropping knowledge! Yeah, no,
Galileo dropped the horns.
So Exley goes to confront Lynn Bracken. This is the one scene that I think does not really work for me. And my question here is, she ends up having sex with him. And of course, it's so that the hush-hush guy can take the pictures. And then that's all set up by Captain Dudley because he's basically going to launch Bud White towards Exley to take him out. But why does Lynn Bracken go through with it?
Because
what does Patchett have on Lynn Bracken?
The question is, why did Lynn Bracken?
Yeah, Bracken.
They don't show the extra call that Pierce Pratchett made.
God damn you,
Sheriff
Brackett.
They don't show the extra call. So Pierce Pratchett calls Lynn and tells her, like, okay, Exley's coming over and we need to frame it with the hush hush guy. Because why would he just call? There's no reason.
Right, but I guess
you would think.
Look, Dave, she still has a day job as a sex worker.
And Pratchett's her pimp. And he's saying like, hey, you have to give it to this cop. I want to get
him out. I understand that. But also, she now has a relationship with Bud. She knows that this is going to rip him apart. So I'm just thinking, and if she was really that close to potentially trying to bail out of there and go back to Arizona, I think this might be the turning point. So I'm just surprised based on her character.
She's still about the business, I think.
I think you're both right, because I think that she is reluctant to do it, but she knows that she has to. She also does not know that the whole point of taking the pictures is to actually give them to Bud so that he goes short fuse and tries to kill Exley.
Yeah. It was all set up because...
Yeah, she's thinking that they're going to use it against Exley and blackmail him, and no one's going to find out about it.
Because they do show before that, they show Pratchett making the phone call the one phone call to Sid.
Right.
But you have to assume that he made two. Well, after the fact, you assume he made two.
Yeah, no. I think it's quite clear that he called her and said, like, we're setting up a little blackmail shoot here. So Sid's coming over and he's going to take pictures of you, and you need to seduce him.
Yeah. Well, so Vincennes, so he strikes a deal with Exley. Exley's going to go to Lynn Bracken's house, and
Lynn.
And Vincennes is supposed to go back to talk to the coroner. Instead, he goes to a bar and then he goes to the captain's house. So he never makes it to the coroner. And when he's at the captain's house, he's telling him about, he's trying to ask the captain about Stensland and the former, and then Meeks. And they were all involved years ago. And when Dudley was the watch commander at that point. And then, you know,
I think
Dudley spins around and shoots him right
in the
heart.
Was in the, didn't he go? He did, because he was doing some paperwork and stuff too. Jack.
Who are you talking about?
Yeah.
Jack?
After he leaves Exley.
Jack was looking at the movie I'm going to pick next.
I'm changing my mind based on this conversation.
He did the research.
Well, this should be this he should
was
be pretty
investigation.
He was investigating. He was looking at the paperwork and stuff. Like the police, the reports.
I don't think he went to a bar.
That's when he found that. No, he went to the, you're talking about when he went to the bar and looked at himself in the mirror.
Right. No, because he...
Oh, the frolic room. He was supposed to meet up with Exley at the frolic room. Meanwhile, Exley is like off having sex with Lynn Bracken. Yeah, and then he did not go to the coroner. he found some police reports, yeah. but there's a lot of information missing. So then he goes to Dudley's
house. Because Dudley was the commander.
To ask him about it, because he was he was their sergeant at the time, I guess, and he wanted some info. Unfortunately for him, he got more than he bargained for.
He got some hot lead.
So the captain spins around and shoots him basically straight in the heart. You know, and over the course of my entire film watching life, I remember being genuinely shocked when this happened. Like when I was watching this movie the first time I saw it, this totally caught me off guard. So this was one of the great surprises in movie history for me in terms of movies I'm watching.
Yeah, it starts to unravel right there. You're like, oh, wait a minute, this is a different story.
Yeah, you were never. No one's ever suspecting that Dudley's in on anything, because this is the total go to your captain's house and talk him through and. And you'll make a breakthrough, and then boom, he just shoots him, turns around and shoots him. It's like, what?
Yeah. It's a great shocking moment. It's a great script. It's a great, throw you off course from where you think the movie's headed. So that's a lot of
fun. Have you told Exley about this? No, I found out and just came here straight. Boom.
Famous last
word. Dead now. Yeah. So after this.
And
Rolo. Oh, and this is where, yes.
Rolo Tomasi. Yeah. I mean, that's just
like. Rolo. Tomasi.
Rolo.
As he's dying.
Rolo. Can you roll me a Rolo?
You can roll a Rolo to your pal. It's chocolate covered caramel.
Kevin Spacey's death scene was quite good. You sort of see the life go out of his eyes. But he said it was like, it's really difficult because James Cromwell is in his face and they're like talking until he dies, right? And he didn't want his eyes to move. Because, he would just naturally, his eyes would track to James Cromwell's eyes. And so he had one of the PAs put a couple of black dots on the opposite wall so that he could just focus on that so his eyes wouldn't move. And they did not. It was quite successful.
Good acting, Kevin Spacey.
I mean, of the three close-up dead bodies, Kevin Spacey, I don't see anything wrong with his dead body performance. Like, I buy that he's dead.
That's why he's an Academy Award winner.
That's why he's an actor. So then... This is where the captain arranges basically to show that he sets the whole thing up to basically show the photos of Exley having sex with Lynn to Bud. So they go back to the hotel and they're initially beating on Danny DeVito a little bit. That's what Bud thinks that they're there to do. But of course, Danny DeVito has been working for the captain the entire time. But then the captain, just to start cleaning up some loose ends, just basically chokes the life out of Danny DeVito. so bye bye.
DeVito. That was a really good scene because. You're thinking like, oh, poor Sid. Like, well, I mean, whatever you think about Sid, they're working him over and they get exactly what they wanted, which was to set Bud off. And then you come back inside and he's like, hey, get me out of here. Like they're, they're working together. Oh my God. Like I didn't see that coming.
Yep. And then this is a fun moment too, because this is where Bud then goes charging back into the office. And I love the confrontation between Bud and Exley, the way that he comes through the door. If you ever see somebody come through the door looking at you that way, you know you're in deep shit because Russell Crowe brings like such a ferocity when he steps to the door. It's just awesome.
I think he comes in and Ed's sitting there at the table and he like shoves this picture in his face and it takes him like about 2 seconds to realize what it is. And the look on his face is like classic. It's like, I'm about to get a beat down.
Yeah. So... That's a fun little fight in the office. I mean, it's definitely, high energy and they're just really getting after it.
He picked up Exley and threw him against these file cabinets. Yeah. It was amazing.
I love that people are trying to like come into the room and break it up. He keeps like shutting the door on them. I
know. And then you can tell he's super pissed off. At the end, he just takes a chair and chucks it through the window. I do like that too.
Yeah.
He's just frustrated. So he's having a bad day. But this is another one of my favorite scenes in the movie because it goes from them fighting to, again, both within each of them, there is this, sort of latent goodness that is there in terms of wanting to do the right thing. It's probably a little closer to the surface for Exley than Bud White maybe, but Exley kind of puts out there that he doesn't think that the Night Owl suspects are the right suspects, and they start talking about kind of what's really happening, and then they start putting, two and two together and basically agree to team up. I do like the transition in their relationship at that point. I think it's really well done.
Yeah, I think it's really good. And they both just want to get to the truth, right? What is actually going on here?
Yeah.
And I think Bud wants to do it for his partner's sake, even though he thinks his partner might have been involved in it to some degree. But he still wants to get the answers, right?
Stanzler's a piece of shit. I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, everyone says that. Look at his fitness report. Terrible.
I do love it, though, because they go and they're going to go start asking questions. So one of the first places they go is to the DA's office. And I love when they're in there because he's just cocky as hell and like, oh, you guys can't touch me. And then you kind of, Bud White's, you know, the DA goes into the bathroom and there's this great moment where like Bud White and Exley look at each other and their eyes are like, yeah, go ahead.
It's just like, do your thing, buddy.
Yeah. And then, yeah, so Bud White goes in there and just starts beating the shit out of the DA and almost drowning him in the toilet. And then I do love that they almost basically just chuck him right out the window. I mean, I'm sure there are going to be some repercussions for this, or there would be at some point. But I love after that whole scene, the DA is laying on the ground and he's in the fetal position, basically.
Poor Ron Rifkin.
And that leads to the big motel showdown.
So I don't know about you guys, but so this is a really complicated plot. But I feel like just everything sort of rushes into this ending. And it's like you're just like learning all of these things in a very short amount of time. And I don't know if it like feels rushed or what. But my only real critique of the movie is that the ending, especially like with the shootout at the Victory Motel, I just felt that one seemed a little too Hollywood for me.
Yeah, I'd agree with it. The shootout is, I don't think it was needed. I think you could have done it in a lower key manner of some sort. But I think once you found out the captain is the one, like once he shoots Jack, I think the rest of it is just, okay, how do we connect the rest of the pieces together? So I didn't feel like it was too quick. I think they're like, okay, how do the different cases and how does it all kind of piece together?
Well, it's sort of like Bud and Ed piece everything together like very quickly, but also there's like body after body after body.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what in your mind was the true catalyst for Dudley to suddenly go on this rampage to clean up all these loose ends?
Oh, I think it's the Night Owl, the fact that didn't
go. But if the Night Owl's kind of open and shut, I don't, like, what's the compelling event to suddenly get Dudley to have to go kill Pierce Patchett, who's generated his
necessary blackmail material? Because he knows actually he's digging into it.
Just kill Exley then.
I think he tried to with that. He wanted Bud to, he can't just like do it himself. He wanted Bud
I understand that, but he would have already made the decision to kill Pierce Patchett by the time he sends Bud after Exley. So he made decisions. It doesn't make a ton of sense that he would have to take those actions unless he feels that Exley is somehow going to truly be able to expose his whole operation.
The only way is if he now he sees them working together and knows that his little plan to have them kill each other off is not going to work and he must be scared and he's trying to tie up the loose ends. Either that or it's greed. And now he's like, okay, I've gone as far as I can with this and key components of our little plot have failed, and so I'm just gonna take control and kill everyone, kill off all my partners, and that's it. But you have no idea because you don't really get any scenes with Dudley and his motivations, right?
Right.
So this is another reason why a critique of the ending.
Well, a couple things about the ending. So one is that it's interesting the way that the shootout is staged because it's really only from the perspective of the characters inside the building. So you don't really know how many people are out there running around. You don't really kind of know the whole situation, how many antagonists are out there trying to get them, that kind of thing. And then I do think that the gunfight itself is really sort of, lackluster isn't the right word, but it's, I don't know, it's kind of, I would agree that it's not the strongest part of the movie. How about that? I mean, I think it works just fine, but it's definitely, it is a little bit action movie at that point.
Yeah. So apparently, I think they were like searching for, you know, a big climax. And then what they realized is that there is a big shootout in the beginning of the book, LA Confidential. And they were like, oh, this is it. Like, we'll take that scene. And that scene will be our big finale. Again, I just thought it was a little too Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not. And the other thing, there are a couple things I like about that, though, is because the adrenaline is just, they're so jacked because they're in this gunfight. So the first couple people that try to get through the door, like Bud White, I think hits one guy with three shots from the shotgun and Exley shoots him two or three times. So that I just, you know, the first guys that are in, it's not really good ammunition management knowing that they're going to be in a siege situation. So, you know, you probably don't need to put three bullets in the guy. I do like the ducking below the floorboards though to shoot the guys in the ankle. Imagine if you're walking past and all of a sudden you get a shotgun blast in the ankle. That probably wouldn't feel that good.
No, it definitely would not.
Reminds me a little bit of, what's the movie? Blanket on it. It's a Coen Brothers film where the guy's underneath the bed and he shoots him in the ankle and then shoots him in the top of the head. I should know the name of this movie.
Miller's Crossing?
Miller's Crossing. Thank you. Yes. There's a good ankle to head shot sequence in that movie.
What other movies have good ankle shot sequences?
Tell you what, I'll start making a list and I'll get back to you on that. And then it's wrapped up with
There's one more thing I just wanted to say about the Victory Motel. They actually have this line. I think Bud says it to Ed. He's like, it's as good a place as any for it to end. And it almost seems very self-referential.
Yeah, I thought he was going to die in it. I don't know if Hollywood had them change the ending and had him live. Or if it was...
So that was another thing. Yeah.
It seemed like that.
That ending seemed very tacked on with him in the car.
Especially like because Ed asked for it, like, oh, there needs to be more than one hero. But then Bud White's not up there receiving a medal either. I thought that was very strange.
Yeah. Well, maybe because he should be in the hospital. I mean, Jesus, he had like a drain hooked up to his face. And he doesn't even get to say anything, right?
Mm-mm.
No, he has no dialogue.
He gets a handshake out of it.
Yeah, but it sort of seems like after the medal ceremony, Ed, you know, he walks up to Lynn and they sort of like walk off together. I was like, Jesus, are they going to be getting together? You know, like it just seemed like Bud was supposed to be dead. And then they were going to go off or something. So I just was wondering if maybe there was an alternate ending and then they went with this one. Or maybe they were just trying to set it up to seem like Bud's dead. And then, nope, he's actually in the car. We just didn't give him any dialogue.
Or a medal.
It just seemed a little weird.
I agree. I think they should.
But I do kind of like the fact that I like that they wrap it back to have Exley still be ambitious at the end.
Yeah.
I like that, right? So he dipped down to doing the right thing, but he still has his ambitious side. So I kind of thought that was a fun way to sort of close loop his character.
What are you referring to?
The medal. Making sure he has the medal. Like, you know, when he's sitting there in the interrogation. Like, and he says, you're talking about a hero. You may need more than one, right? So
the interrogation. That was another little masterful Ed Exley manipulation.
He's willing to lie.
He wants.
Advance his career.
We should assume that.
But he's right. You know, he's sort of like come full circle and he's like Dudley, except with actual ethics.
Right. Well, and that's, we didn't really talk about that, but there is the big moment at the end where the captain is the last one of the bad guys that's alive in the shootout, and Exley's alive, and the captain goes walking away as if he's going to, and he's trying to convince Exley to let him do the talking, and they'll, you know, he'll make Exley a hero, and this is where Exley chooses to shoot him in the back with a shotgun, and goodbye, captain.
Yeah, so he got the lesson.
Yep, he took the lesson that the captain was asking him to learn, and he applied it to the captain, so thanks, captain.
Lucky enough. He's smart enough to then frame it just the way like the captain would have.
Right.
And to get the police chief and the DA and everyone to buy into, you know, hey, this could be a win-win. This is how we take a horrible scandal and
spin it, you
know, make it into a hero story.
Yep.
By the way, the LAPD lost a lot of detectives that night at the Victor Motel.
Yeah.
Because I think those are all like cops.
Yeah. Right? Assume.
Oh yeah. That's what I assume. So
yeah.
So how would they have explained that? I'm super curious to know. How would they have framed up that situation?
The only people who died were cops.
Dirty cops.
And there's
everyone who died was a dirty cop.
Yeah, just dirty cops all over the place.
Yeah.
All right, well, I think we have sort of tried to navigate the movie. Like, you know, I think we've looped back on ourselves multiple times, so we'll see how it sounds.
It ends
up... How about just any other...
I was going to say, it does end up being a simple story of...
No, how?
What?
Sorry.
But actually, you know what? How about this? I'm curious. Let's see. I'll give this to, Colin. So describe the actual crime that went down in relation to the Night Owl very specifically.
The actual crime?
Well, and why it had to happen when it happened.
Oh, so the Night Owl Massacre?
Yeah.
So I don't actually really understand why it had to happen that way. I think they went in to kill Stensland, but I just don't know why they would go in and like massacre a bunch of other people as well.
But it's because Stensland and Meeks took down the heroin because they were the two team shooters that were doing these things. And so,
definitely. Yeah. They were
at that point, they were going to make a play with the heroin to do something with it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So Meeks is the one who they took the heroin in the beginning. You just didn't know it. Yeah. Stensland and Meeks were the two shooter team.
Yeah. So I guess the question is, do you stage that attack at the Night Owl because you want it to look like a random robbery and you're going to just kill other people to satisfy that need?
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, why not just take Stensland on the street somewhere or whatever?
I think maybe they went in there and were like, hey, Stens, like, you need to come with us. Like, we need to have a conversation. And he fought back and they killed him and they had to kill everyone else.
Kill the witnesses.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think they meant to do that. Because why? Why would you create this huge story? You know, you want it to be like on the hush hush.
Right. Okay, I have a couple of little random facts here and there. So apparently in October 2020, Brian Hegeland confirmed that there was a sequel that was under development that was going to star Chadwick Boseman and Russell Crowe and Guy Pearce.
Oh, wow.
And it was going to be set in 1974.
Oh, wow. That would have been really interesting.
So that's interesting. And obviously, that won't be happening now. A couple other notes. So James Ellroy, apparently his description of Bud White in the book is that he is the biggest cop in LAPD.
Yeah.
Like he's just a giant, enormous man that is, you know, and Bud White definitely takes
he's
on the
mountain
physical.
That rides.
Yeah. He's the mountain that rides of the LAPD.
Yeah. Crow, he was like, how am I supposed to play this guy? You know, he's supposed to be huge. He actually, I think he put on a little weight too. And he specifically asked the costumers to make his clothes all like a little tighter. So it was sort of like bulging out.
Yeah.
But I don't think it really matters. I think James Ellroy even might have said that, you know, these characters, the actors don't fit the physical description from the book. But, yeah. You know, ultimately it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I mean, Hugh Jackman's too tall, man, for Wolverine. He just can't do it at all.
Yeah. They should have like Jeff Richmond, Tina Fey's husband. He should play Wolverine.
Tom Cruise.
Because he's like 5'2" and he's very hairy. So, yeah, Emily would get that joke. You guys. Jesus.
Sorry.
Okay, and then the last point that I thought was interesting doing research is that apparently it says a very poorly executed pilot that starred Kiefer Sutherland as a completely unrecognizable Jack Vincennes was produced, but the series was not picked up afterwards.
I sort of remember that coming out.
I don't remember that.
Really?
And yeah, I don't know if I actually watched it, but you know what? It's on the Blu-ray special feature, so I got to go check it out.
Oh, are you serious? They have a pilot episode of that? Oh, weird.
Yeah.
What year was that? I mean, was that, that must have been pre...
I think it was 2000. 24?
Huh. Weird. All right, well, anything else you guys want to offer up in terms of interesting trivia or anything else you want to talk about?
What do you think about the score?
I think the score is really good. I like the score.
Yeah, Jared Goldsmith did a nice job with this. And then the score itself is really good. And then I like the use of, you know, sort of the 50s era songs
right.
during certain scenes.
I know, well actually,
in fact, he was nominated for an Academy Award.
He was, yeah. And I think that there are moments in the film where the score works really well. Like when Exley is going into the Night Owl Diner, there's a couple of sort of, you know, ominous piano notes that get played. Mm-hmm. And so the score in particular for the moments before there's going to be conflict, the way that it's used to raise the tension, I think it works really, really well. So I like the score quite a bit. It's not, the other thing is the score is not overbearing. So, you know, you're not hearing music constantly throughout. So it's just the fact that it's used in a minimalist way, I think is actually it makes it even more effective when it does show up.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Do you know what Jerry Goldsmith won his one Academy Award for?
Give me a hint.
1977 horror movie.
The Amityville Horror?
Yeah, The Omen.
Oh, The Omen.
All right, well, you guys ready to wrap?
I'm ready to wrap.
And then I have to make my pick.
You do?
So, yeah, cool.
Okay, so... Marcus, your closing thoughts, LA Confidential.
Really fun movie. If you haven't watched it, I don't know why you listen to this podcast. You should have watched it.
and don't worry, because if you listen to this podcast, you can't get any of the details out of the plot. We tried to describe it, so you're fine.
We say spoilers, but we don't make any sense either. Great characters, great acting, all around fun crime noir movie set in Los Angeles. 1950s LA, great place.
What's your letter grade?
I would give it a solid A.
Colin?
It's just like one of those all-time great period movies. So well done with just an amazing ensemble cast. If you like anything about like period LA, this is a must. Watch it a couple times and you'll understand what's going on. But it's not that bad, really. Like they do actually do a nice job of putting all the pieces together at the end. So even though I didn't remember exactly what happened, I clearly understand how everything fit together. So it's really well written, really great acting. It looks amazing. If you like noir at all, you have to watch this movie.
And your letter grade?
A solid A.
Yes. Well, so we are going to all come in at a solid A. And I'll start by saying I think this movie is incredibly smart. And I like the fact that you have to pay attention while you're watching to figure out what's going on. And again, it just seems like fewer and fewer movies of that ilk are being made today. So I do love the fact that you really have to engage, you gotta pay attention, you gotta try to put things together in your head as you're watching it. So the fact that it challenges you that way, it makes it very engaging and it's very, you know, it's an invigorating watch. The atmosphere of this movie in terms of the fact that it's period and all the stuff that we talked about in terms of the filing cabinets and the doors and the floor and the cars and just
the
everything.
Paneling and
it's just, I mean, it just looks great. It really And it's pretty cool because it does it in a way where it doesn't hit you over the head with it. It's just kind of you're sort of immersed into it and you're there. It's not as if you're looking at something that you think is a period, you know, like a set that's being designed.
You never go like, oh, that's how they did it in the 50s.
Right. You're just sort of, the movie starts and you're just rolling right along. And it's more just the, again, the kind of that overall aesthetic is just, it's consistent, but it's not like boom in your face. Like even some of the, you know, they show a couple things like movie premieres and all that, but you never really get too close to one of those to, you know, have like that wow moment necessarily. It's just kind of, it's all there. So I do think the script with some of the turns that it takes is really great. Again, the captain turn is one of the all-time surprises for me in movie history. So just anytime a movie can catch you off guard, I love that. And I do think the characters, particularly the three leads and their ability and the arcs that they have to go through, it's really interesting to watch, right? I mean, watching, you know, Kevin Spacey kind of go from that sort of self-loathing to I'm going to try to be a good guy and I'm going to try to help. I love that. And then both, I think, Russell Crowe and Guy Pearce have those similar kind of, you know, they're able to go in and out of the gray area as they're traveling along. And it just makes for really interesting, compelling characters. I think these are just fantastically compelling characters. And this movie is just packed full of great actors. So solid A, and love this movie. It's definitely up there for me. Might be in my top 20. I'd have to write out my top 20 and figure that out, because that's always I think of all the movies we've done, I've probably had three that I've said are in the top 20. But you guys keep me honest. At some point, I'll make that list.
Do it. Make the list. So, Dave.
Yes.
What's your pick for next time?
This one's going to come as a complete out of left field surprise, because I was thinking about doing something that was, you know, another important movie, another serious movie, and then I realized that I want kind of a Tango and Cash episode. So, yeah.
Well, so tell us what your original one was going to be, because I'm just curious now.
I was going to go Fight Club.
Mm. Okay.
But I'll let one of you guys.
We'll do that. We'll do that some point coming up. Yeah, definitely.
But no, we are going to take a complete 180-degree turn, and you guys are going to help me answer the question.
Who framed Roger Rabbit?
No. please no.
You're never going to, trust me, if it's my pick, you will never have to answer that particular question. No, you guys are going to help me answer the question. Is this the most tone-deaf action movie ever made? Is it a homage to 80s movies?
Is it Skyscraper?
Is it satire? Yes, we are going to watch 2018's Dwayne The Rock Johnson in Skyscraper.
Oh, boy. Oh,
man. And we're going to discuss that movie, because that movie is absolutely ridiculous, and it should make for a fun conversation. Wait, something a little bit lighter than some of our last movies.
What was it during this conversation that led you to Skyscraper?
Oh, I think the 14th or 17th time we went, no, wait, did this happen? No, did that guy do this? Did that
okay.
Because okay. There is going to be zero ambiguity as to what's happening in Skyscraper. So.
Well, that should be interesting. I have seen the movie, but it was a while ago. So,
can't be too long.
That'll be fun. I love nitpicking. So,
that's what I'm saying. So, you want to talk about a movie that we can just rip to pieces and have some fun doing it? That's the movie. That's kind of the mood that I'm in for our next one. So, let's do it.
Cool.
All right. So, our next film is going to be the spectacular 2018 Dwayne The Rock Johnson's Skyscraper. And otherwise,
terrible pick.
I think you enjoyed it. What was that?
It's a terrible pick.
Well, I mean, you did Natural Born Killer, so I'd
great pick. Give a shit. One of our top 10.
All right. Well, we hope you enjoyed our, I don't know.
What long
you
and this? Rambling discussion.
Definitely long and rambling for sure. We tried to do our best to do justice to what's a really good movie. The conversation probably did not live up to the movie. Sorry about that. But otherwise, we hope you enjoyed the podcast. And I'll say, this is the Real DMC Podcast. Signing off.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye,
everybody. Goodbye.
I don't have a good LA Confidential line to throw in here.
How about good luck editing that one, Colin?
Yeah.
It's only 2.5 hours.
Well, shut up, Marcus. I'm going to violate you on a kitty raper bee.